Morning.
Good morning, Chief. Both attorneys are present and both have advised they can see the clock.
Very good. Thank you. And we're waiting for the good Justice Bevin. There he is.
I'm here. I'm having issues with my video, so I'm opening the laptop. I guess you can see me from there.
We're good. You're looking marvelous, by the way, Richard, with your laptop.
Yeah, great. Now I just have to put up the screen.
This may not end well.
All right, let's just go for it, shall we?
Good enough. Thank you. At this point in time, we're on record in State of Idaho versus Nicole Knighting. Is that Knighting correctly pronounced?
I believe so.
Okay, very well. At this time, the appellant Knighting is represented by Sally Cooley, and on behalf of the respondent, State of Idaho, John McKinney. Any other preliminary matters?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
You may proceed, madam.
May it please the court, counsel. Ms. Knighting appeals from her conviction after a jury found her guilty of trafficking in methamphetamine, introduction of contraband into a jail, and possession of paraphernalia. She asserts that the jury verdict finding her guilty of introduction of contraband to a jail was not based on sufficient evidence where her entry into the jail was not voluntary. She was taken there while under arrest. Now, in this case, at approximately 5:40 in the morning, officers responded to a call of a potential vehicle theft or break-in outside of Motel 6. Ms. Knighting was there, and she and her friend were trying to start a car. In fact, the car was registered to Ms. Knighting, but while talking to the friend, officers learned that he had a room at Motel 6. He gave them the key and then consented to them searching the room. The room was searched, and a purse containing Ms. Knighting's debit card, as well as some drug paraphernalia and prescription drugs, were located. Ms. Knighting was arrested. During a pat-down search, her groin area contained a bulky item, according to the testimony of the officer. Although she explained it was a sanitary napkin, the officers present at the scene continued to believe Ms. Knighting had narcotics hidden in her pants. However, they did transport her to jail without searching her further. She was asked twice if she had anything illegal on her, to which she said no. She was also advised that if anything illegal was found on her person when she was in jail, she would be charged with bringing contraband into a jail. She denied having anything illegal. At the jail, she was strip searched and an envelope containing methamphetamine was visible between her buttocks. After the jury trial, Ms. Knighting was convicted of trafficking in methamphetamine for over 1 ounce and of introducing contraband into a jail for the same methamphetamine that was found in her pants. Now, in Idaho, the statute at issue here is introduction of contraband into a correctional facility. That's 18-2510, paren 3, paren A. And that provides no person, including a prisoner, shall knowingly introduce or attempt to introduce major contraband within a correctional facility. Now, this is a general intent crime. However, the state must still prove that Ms. Knighting committed the crime voluntarily. The ground rule is that conduct must be voluntary before it can be classified as criminal. It's one of the fundamental foundational rules of law. And we know from Lefebvre, at all events, it is clear that criminal liability requires the activity in question to be voluntary. The deterrent function of the criminal law would not be served by imposing sanctions for involuntary action, as such action cannot be deterred. And the Model Penal Code gives a little bit of an explanation of what is not a voluntary act. Things that are done under hypnosis, a reflex or a convulsion, something done during while someone was unconscious or asleep. And here, the elements in this statute that the court needs to interpret are that on about a certain date in the state of Idaho, Ms. Knighting knowingly introduced or attempted to introduce major contraband within a correctional facility. Now at the trial, the evidence showed that she possessed methamphetamine. She possessed it while she was working on her car. The evidence did not show she voluntarily introduced it to the jail because she was arrested and brought to jail. She was not voluntarily at jail. She did not knowingly introduce this methamphetamine into the jail. Now, the jury could not have reasonably found that she voluntarily introduced it to the jail because she did no voluntary act to bring her into the jail.
You said that she didn't knowingly bring it into the jail. Certainly, she was aware that she had it on her person and that if she entered the jail, she would be bringing it into the jail, correct?
She did know she had it on her person. That is correct, Your Honor. But the word introduce requires, and I'll give you a dictionary definition there. Merriam-Webster says, introduce means to lead or bring in, especially for the first time. She did not bring this methamphetamine into the jail voluntarily because she was not in the jail or brought to the jail voluntarily. She did not choose to go to jail that night. A voluntary act requires more than just awareness. It requires a choice. And that was, and here, the introduction is the word introduce is even more so than possession. She didn't just possess it on the property. She introduced, which implies some intent or desire and a voluntary act to go into the jail, which we don't have. She was forcibly placed in the jail.
So I'm a little bit confused about how we read this statute. Are we supposed to interpret it that the statute says a person knowingly and voluntarily introduces the substance?
Well, I think that we can look at this as the actus rea, the act that gives rise to the liability. And so the act that we're looking at here is the introduction to a jail. We know, of course, she knew that she had methamphetamine on her, but she did not choose to go to that jail. She had that methamphetamine on her the entire time before she had any idea that the cops were going to be called, would come arrest her and take her in. Now, I think a good way to break this down is how the Oregon Appellate Court in Tibbetts broke it down back in 2002.
But doesn't knowledge usually suffice for the actus reus?
Not in this case, Your Honor. There has to be an affirmative act of some kind to bring her into the a criminal conduct. And in Tibbetts, the court did a good job of explaining the act and an offense that requires more than one act. So we know she possessed it, but we also are charging her with bringing it into the jail. So that's two acts. So under Tibbetts discusses offenses that require more than one act. They talk about the model penal code and how the model penal code says that some offenses only require one voluntary act and the rest of the acts can be involuntary. And they give the example of a vehicular manslaughter case, a vehicular homicide case. So in that case, if liability is imposed, it must be attributed to prior voluntary action or a prior omission included in the course of conduct culminating in the crime, the homicide in that case, such as the act of driving or failure to stop when the driver felt that illness was approaching. And in that way, liability can be imposed without each act having to be involuntary, but it has to be a course of conduct. And the Tibbetts court also specified that it needed to be something that was reasonably foreseeable or likely consequence of the voluntary act. So in that case, it was the driver continuing to drive, knowing they were feeling unwell, probably at risk of passing out. And then the subsequent acts that occurred with the unconscious driver, you know, crossing the median, hitting another car, killing another individual, those were all the involuntary acts, but they can still be attributed to that one voluntary act. And we don't have that here. We don't have any foreseeability. And that's what the Tibbetts court found as well. That Mr. Tibbetts.
Do the appellant's answers to the questions by law enforcement as to whether or not she had any controlled substances on her person constitute acts?
No, Your Honor. They don't serve to make her decisions voluntary in this case. Your Honor is talking about there's kind of a split of opinion in the United States amongst the states. Some of them, such as Oregon, the nearby state of Washington, and New Mexico, have found that there must be something beyond the transport of the person to the jail to charge them with contraband. And some of the other jurisdictions have found that an officer simply asking a defendant, do you have anything on you? And if you do, you could be charged with bringing contraband into jail, serves to make that voluntary. But that is not affecting her, that does not serve to make her conduct in bringing the item into the jail voluntary.
But if she had answered yes, they would have likely patted her down or searched her further, or else been aware that she brought something in and they were causing her to bring it in at that point after she had notified them to the contrary. So how could it not be seen as a choice that she made to bring it in if she was asked whether she had it or not?
Well, and I think this comes down to the voluntariness of her act in responding to this question. So she's presumably being asked to either disclose the methamphetamine she has on her person or face additional charges if she is found with the methamphetamine on her person later while in the jail.
So basically, as Justice Stegner might put it, this was a Sophie's choice concerning her Fifth Amendment rights.
Yes, that would be correct. It's not a true option or a true choice. They didn't say, or you could exercise your right to remain silent here, or we'll give you immunity. If you tell us that you have something on you, we won't charge you for it, and we won't charge you for bringing it into the jail. That would have been more along the lines of a true choice. And simply because she is aware of this and continues to deny it doesn't mean that she voluntarily intended to bring that item into the jail.
Well, don't defendants though always have a choice as to whether to tell the truth to the police or lie to them? And if they lie to the police, they're facing more charges, obstruction of an officer, for example. Isn't that inherent in any law enforcement questioning?
Yes, but in this case, she was in custody and she was being asked essentially the classic penalty situation. And I know that that's been discussed in various decisions, such as the recent decision in Aikens, a Court of Appeals opinion, Powell, and then Van Komen, of course. It's not a true choice, and it doesn't make her presence there voluntary. So one interesting and illustrative example here would be State v. Martin, and that was a case back in 1944, the Alabama Court of Appeals, in which Mr. Martin, the court concluded that a single voluntary act, when the actus reus contains multiple elements, is insufficient to establish liability. And in that case, the police went to Mr. Martin's home where he was intoxicated. They picked him up and forcibly carried him, from the language of the opinion, out into the street where he proceeded to manifest a drunken condition by using loud and profane language. He was then arrested for that and convicted of public drunkenness. And that's what happened here. Ms. Knighting was possessing the methamphetamine, but she had possessed it from the get-go. She didn't do anything new to repossess it until she was brought to the jail. So it wasn't reasonably foreseeable for her that by having the drugs in her pants when she was working on her car, that she would then be brought to the jail and charged with a different offense, an additional offense of bringing that item into the jail. And I think here that the word introduce.
Excuse me, Ms. Goldberg, but when she says, no, I don't have anything on me, isn't a reasonable inference that she's attempting to introduce the methamphetamine to the jail?
She's attempting to not confess. She's attempting to avoid criminal penalties for everything that she's got on her.
But isn't the effect of saying, no, I don't have anything on me, tantamount to saying, let me go into the jail and I will have then broken the law that's intended to prevent people from bringing contraband into the jail? I mean, it seems to me like she's trying to get it into the jail when she says, no, I don't have anything on me.
And Your Honor, she's trying not to be guilty of having the amount of methamphetamine she had on her. She's trying to avoid confessing. She's trying to avoid being convicted for this crime. So if there was information that she knew she was going to go to jail and hid the methamphetamine on her, then a jury could find, yes, she intended to. There was an intent. She did an act with knowledge that she would be going to jail. So for example, if she was home and a warrant was served on her house and she, the house was searched and they said, okay, we're going to arrest you. And she said, let me go put on my shoes. And the officer watches her go back, put on her shoes, and she slips, you know, a packet of drugs into her shoe as they're arresting her and she knows she's being arrested. That's a different story. Here, we don't have any indication that she knew. There was no information for the jury that they heard that indicated that she was going to be arrested prior to her possessing the methamphetamine. Now, in
so we March, judge her. We judge her intent then by the time at the moment she put the drugs into her pants. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting that in order to satisfy the voluntariness of her actions, she must do something indicating that there's a belief of being arrested or that she wants to take these drugs into the jail, not simply an avoidance of liability for all charges.
So under your analysis, then, the only way she could be guilty of this crime is that she put the drugs into her pants, and at the time she did so, she thought, man, if I get arrested today, I might get to bring this into a jail?
Not exactly, Your Honor. I think there needs to be some indication that she knew she was going to go to jail, whether that be the police are, in her house and telling her she's going to be arrested, or whether she is going to turn herself into jail to serve some predetermined time. In that situation, if she put drugs on her and then went and checked into the jail, clearly she's trying to bring those drugs into the jail. She has done an act in furtherance, and the jury can infer that she intended because she knew she was going to go to jail. In this case, when someone who has meth in their pocket is essentially picked up and forcibly carried into the jail, whether you tell them that there could be an enhanced penalty or not, it's still not a voluntary act. The act needs to be voluntary in order to satisfy this, is unless it's reasonable, foreseeable, or the course of conduct. And in this case, we don't have that.
Did the jury instructions include an instruction with regard to act having to be voluntary and act having to be voluntary?
I don't believe they did. They included the act and intent. And the language is slipping my mind at this point. There must be a union of or joint operation of act and intent. And so she must have acted in some way and had the intent. So there's no act and intent when she is when she is transported against her will into the jail.
And is that an adequate instruction as far as this issue is concerned? The combination of act and intent?
Well, in some states, they have requested, defendants have requested a voluntariness instruction. And that was, I think that was in an Oregon statute. In Oregon, they requested the voluntariness, and the district court did not give the instruction, and the court found that was also error. Because they should have had an instruction regarding voluntariness. And in fact, Oregon statute is fairly similar to Idaho's statute. It does have the same knowingly introduce, contraband, and then jail, the same basic requirements. And so I think that a voluntariness instruction or explanation would have benefited.
What would that instruction have looked like?
Something along the lines of, for conduct to be voluntary, I'm not a wordsmith on jury instructions. If I have a little time in rebuttal, I can find that case and read what the district court declined to give. So if I may reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very good. Thank you, ma'am. On behalf of the respondent, sir.
Please, please, the court, counsel. I think one thing that needs to be clarified here is that in regard to voluntariness, there are two totally and separate aspects to the arguments that have been made throughout this nation, and they need to be separated. The first, and Justice Brody, you brought this up, whether or not voluntariness is something that's required. Now, we have not argued that it's not, because the law appears to be fairly clear that in regard to actus reus, which has to be joined with whatever intent there may be, that there also has to be a voluntary act. And so we're talking about actus reus and the voluntariness that must accompany that. And the Model Penal Code, I think we set out in our brief, when we didn't put much law out there, because it appears to be just the underlying assumption of American jurisprudence that acts that are not done voluntarily cannot be criminally punished. And so I think the Model Penal Code puts it in terms of it being an implied part of the actus reus requirement. And so we're talking about, in the first instance, we're talking about whether or not Ms. Knighting was voluntarily or involuntarily doing her conduct of possessing the methamphetamine that was found in her on the jail.
But Ms. McKinnon, I'm trying to process what you just said. Are you agreeing that voluntariness, while a part of the model penal code, is also part of the common law?
I did a lot of research, or at least some research, and I think there are mixed decisions that try to trace where voluntariness comes from. I think in one of our decisions, I read the I forgot now which case it is, but it talks about willfulness and knowingly. And when you combine those, it would seem to me to speak of voluntariness, which is a requirement. And certainly in the Johnson case, and in the, I think it's, the Baldwin case, I think there's a good authority there that would suggest that it's willful and knowingly that is brought out in the Baldwin case. And in Johnson, the word voluntary or a form of voluntary is used three times in the paragraph of the brief by Ms. Knighting on page 11. And so it seems to me a given, and we have not argued against it, that as opposed to let's assume a ridiculous scenario where Ms. Knighting was arrested and the methamphetamine was known to be on her and it was taped down on her so she couldn't get to it and she was handcuffed, she couldn't get to it, and despite her pleas and cries to get this contraband off of her, she was taken to the jail. That would be an involuntary act. And that's what we're assuming because of the voluntariness requirement that seems to be implied in all of criminal law, that would not be punishable by our criminal statutes. So that's all we're saying when we talk about voluntariness. And in this case, the majority rule in talking about the mens rea, I'm sorry, the actus reus type of voluntariness says that yes, under the broad umbrella of being arrested and being transported to a jail, that may obviously be involuntary. No one chooses typically to go to jail. But within that context, people have the ability to make certain choices. And the majority says that when you're given the choice, whether it's just simply, hey, we see contraband on you, or if you have any contraband, or if it's a further warning and given of, in this case, correct information that if you do have contraband and you don't turn it over, there is this other charge awaiting you. That itself, even though we're under the big umbrella of involuntarily being taken to jail, there's that choice within that context that is free that the defendants make. And if they make that choice, then that is the voluntary act that we're talking about. The majority of states say that.
Does this case change any if she had told the officer that I'm invoking my right to remain silent when he questioned whether she had anything illegal on her?
I don't think so. I think, well, she didn't, but had she invoked her right to remain silent, I think we get to now the Fifth Amendment, which is different than the actus reus argument on voluntariness. So jumping to the Fifth Amendment, In this case, had she invoked her right to silence, I don't know, and was silent, I don't know how it would have changed anything. She was going to be found with the 31 grams of methamphetamine that was stuck between her butt, no matter what, in all probability. She made the choice. She rolled the dice, hoping that she would be able to somehow, and it's absurd because the officers had already seen it and questioned her and felt it, but she nonetheless rolled the dice, hoping to get that methamphetamine into the jail with her. And so the inevitability that it was going to be found really, really places a minimum on whatever response she would have made in the officer's question of, do you have contraband on you? And then the warning, if you do, and the warning was simply correct. What is being posed under the Fifth Amendment, and I would like to backtrack and say, by the way, that's been waived. It wasn't presented in the appellant's opening brief. it was simply a footnote in the statement of facts, and then it was argued for the first time in the reply brief. But even if this court gets there, the Fifth Amendment does not protect that statement. And even if it did, there was such a marginal use or tainting of her rights, because in the end, she was going to be found with that methamphetamine upon entry. Further, in this case, she didn't claim a right to silence. I don't understand where her Fifth Amendment argument comes from, because she's in effect saying that because I was compelled to disclose whether I had or that I had contraband on me, but I didn't, somehow my right against self-incrimination was violated. And further, the U.S. Supreme Court has said the Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination, again, I'm sorry, privilege against self-incrimination, does not pertain to telling lies. And here, she lied every time. She was asked several times, multiple times, according to Officer, I think, Nunley, about whether or not she had contraband. She denied each time. She, again, repeated that lie after being warned at the jail. So there is no Fifth Amendment privilege active here.
But if she had answered the question, yes, I have an envelope in between my cheeks. Does that statement get used against her in the underlying charge?
It may have, but it would have had very, very little value in the case, because nothing speaks louder than the fact that this 31 grams of meth was found exactly where it was. The need for any statements, whether it's a denial to impeach her or to her admission, adds very, very little in this case, where it was so clear that the contraband was going to be found. And the fact that she knew, it would be absurd for her to have argued she did not know that she possessed it based on where it was found. So
if we're going to get into a deep Fifth Amendment analysis on this, don't we also have to look at the, don't cases look at the intent of the questioning? For example, if a defendant is asked their name, their address, and those type of things, even if in custody, typically that's not considered a Fifth Amendment violation. And here she was being asked a question about whether she had any contraband. Certainly independent of bringing new charges against her, those questions, wouldn't they be justifiable for public safety, the safety of the jail, the safety of the officers, had nothing to do with a new criminal investigation?
Yes. Yeah, and certainly the word contraband would include weapons, anything that might be a danger to inmates inside or to correctional officers inside. So absolutely, it would have been. So the Fifth Amendment does not apply in this case. Her claim that it does simply goes against Brogan, the United States Supreme Court's decision that says, no, the Fifth Amendment does not apply to lies. You're not protected to lie. And that's what she did here. And given the majority view that, and I before I go on, the Tippetts case, there's a tandem of cases, Tippetts and Cole. The Washington Court of Appeals, it's not the Supreme Court, but the Washington Court of Appeals ruled that in that case, because the state did not argue and did not present a, what I'll call a choice argument, they did not make that argument in Tippetts. And so the court said they could have made that argument, but they didn't. And so the court went on to talk about the state's alternative argument, which was based on whether or not the defendant, and solely based on the defendant's awareness or the arrestee's awareness that the contraband was on their person, whether that was enough. And Tippett said, no, that's not enough. There's got to be something more. Well, the Cole case, New Mexico Court of Appeals, said, basically expressly copied Tippett's and said the same thing is true here. And then he quoted language from Tippett's, and it makes it really, really clear that both courts understood that if there's a choice, it makes a difference. And the Cole decision says, in referring to the Tippetts Oregon case, it says, the state of Oregon argued, as does the state in the present case, that as long as the defendant was aware that he possessed the marijuana when the officers took him into the jail, that fact alone provides a sufficient basis for saying he voluntarily introduced the marijuana into the jail. Then it goes on to say, the Oregon Court of Appeals stated that a voluntary act requires something more than awareness. It requires an ability to choose which course to take. That is, an ability to choose whether to commit the act. It gives rise to the criminal liability. So both Tippetts and Cole seem to suggest that in a situation here, like here, and where the state argues, like we're arguing now, that there was a choice that was made by the arrestee on the way or at the jail, whether or not to turn over the contraband, that is the choice that is made. That is the voluntary moment where the bells go off and ding, ding. We now have a voluntary choice. We now fit the actus reus requirement. And as the other courts have said, there is no Fifth Amendment privilege here at all, where the claim is that the lie should be protected. And I do—
Mr. McKinney, I'm going back to the question about voluntary. It sounds like the issue of voluntariness was not instructed on. And is that a jury question as to whether something is voluntary?
Well, ultimately, had been inserted in here and raised, maybe as a necessity defense, something of that sort, it would have been. But here, it wasn't separated out.
Voluntariness is part of the common law, as you agree. It's a question if there's a clue as to the facts as to whether that should have been instructed. And I mean, if that were an instruction in this case and the jury had concluded that, yes, in a voluntary way when she sought methamphetamine into the jail, we might not be having this discussion.
We might not. And I think it, in a general intent crime, I'm not aware that the voluntariness, that a voluntariness instruction is generally given. It could have been, and that certainly would have placed it within the jury to determine whether or not her, I'll call it a sub act of making the choice whether or not to turn over the contraband, given the multiple chances, whether that constituted voluntariness. It simply was not brought up in this case, and yes, perhaps it should have been.
Mr. McKinney, let me raise an issue that I've had in going over this case, preparing for today's hearing, but really hasn't been raised that I've seen in the briefs or by anyone, but Ms. Knighting was charged with possession, not introduction of a substance into the jail. In fact, the information charged her with that, the verdict, the jury convicted her of possession, but in the instruction, record page 157, it said they added this element in that she introduced it. Now, as I read the statute, introducing contraband is a separate subsection than just possessing. So it appears it's a type of a variance, but it's a variance in my view that inured to the defendant's benefit, because simply possessing in the jail is much easier to prove than all this stuff we're talking about in introducing. Is there any thought given to why the judge instructed that you have to introduce the substance to also be guilty of just possessing it?
I have not looked back and reviewed the court's comments or that discussion. I don't know. Justice Bevin.
Frankly, my thought was it was just an oversight, that somehow this instruction was just put in the jury in before the jury, and nobody thought about the fact that this woman was never charged with introducing the substance. She was just charged with possessing it. So it seems to me that that instruction inured to her benefit, because now here we are talking about the issues on appeal. But at the same time, the jury verdict, the information, the initial charging document all simply charged possessing. It seems to me if a simple possession is a simple possession, you have to knowingly possess in the jail. Much different question than what we're all talking about here today.
I did not go back and look at the charging documents, so I'm surprised to hear that there's not a separate allegation of introduction or attempting to introduce contraband into the jail.
Just alleges she did possess major contraband methamphetamine within the Bonneville County Jail. So, okay.
That may have been the just the buzzwords for that charge that the court was using.
No, but I think if you look at 1825.10 sub 3 there, then multiple sublevels to the statute that include introduction separate from possession. It also includes conveying contraband to a prisoner or receiving or removing it. So those are all subsections of sub 3 under 2510. But here we're talking about introducing, which in my view was never even charged.
I had noticed that, Justice Bevin.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to actually leave one last thought here. The argument that's been made on the Fifth Amendment does not seem to really connect to anything that was said to Ms. Knighting. And that is really, it seems to me that the argument is with the law itself, that being put in this tension, this bind, that if she were to have retained the contraband on her, she'd have an additional charge. She chose not to. But if she chose to admit or to turn over the contraband, then she would be charged with that crime itself, the possessory crime, and not the additional one. Seems to me to just be a complaint against how the law works. And all of the correctional officers were doing was telling her, this is how the law works. They're giving her correct information. And yes, I know that they asked her to, do you have any contraband on you? But they're doing that in order to inform her that if she does, here's how the law operates, and you're going to have another charge. I fail to see how that is any more harmful than saying nothing to her. In fact, it seems to have been helpful to her to tell her that here's what's going to happen if you continue on bringing this item that we can feel and see on your person. If it's contraband, you're going to have an additional charge. That seems to be helpful and to assist her in her knowledge of what her consequences are. So it appears to me that her difficulty is not with what the officers did, it's with the law itself. And I don't know that that's been challenged here, frankly. I haven't seen it. So with that, unless there are any further questions, I ask this court to affirm Ms. Knighting's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. And how much time does the appellant have?
13 minutes, Your Honor.
Ma'am, may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Picking up where I failed to find a jury instruction, the case that I was thinking of was State v. Thaxton. That's an Oregon Court of Appeals case from 2003. Once again, we had similar facts. However, in that case, the defendant or the arrestee knew he was going to be going to jail. The officer had smelled marijuana. There was marijuana in the car. And so he put some marijuana in his sock. But as part of the error asserted in that case, the defense counsel had asked for an instruction and assigned as error the court's refusal to give one, saying criminal liability requires the performance by a person of conduct which is a voluntary act or the omission to perform an act of which the person is capable of. And that was based on an Oregon statute. However, we do have this type of case law in Idaho as well. Some language about voluntariness comes from State v. Missenberger, and I don't believe I cited that in my briefing. I have been doing a little additional research about voluntariness in case the court had questions today. Certainly supplement if necessary.
I apologize for interrupting. It appears we've lost Mr. McKinney.
Do you want me to continue?
No. Could we wait until we get him back? Here he comes.
Now.
John, are you there? Can you hear me, John? John, can you hear the proceedings? Madam Clerk, do we have a phone number for Mr. McKinney?
I just have an office number for him right now. Let me try emailing him really quick.
Okay, thank you. Oh, there he is. John, can you hear? Are you back on?
I'm wondering if he just went with audio instead of video, if he might have better luck. It appears his internet may be having some issues.
Okay, why don't you email him that, please? You know, he's going to come on the audio swearing like a drunken sailor and not know it's on the audio if he's anything like me. I hope he isn't.
Your Honor, would you like me to pause the recording while we wait for him?
Yeah, maybe we should have done that before.
As I was saying, I was talking about the voluntariness and the requirement in Idaho. I had referenced State v. Missenberger, which is an Idaho Supreme Court case from 1963. In that case, the court said that intent is a necessary ingredient of every crime. This is true in the sense the act must have been committed by the defendant voluntarily and not under duress or acting under compulsion of superior force. Now, in this case, we can't use the requirement put to Ms. Knighting. So she was told, if you don't tell us that you have illegal contraband and we find some, we're going to charge you with this new crime. But they can't use that to make up for the involuntary transport and her involuntary presence there. Because when they're asking her this, she's basically under the gun. And this is where the Fifth Amendment comes in. I did not make a claim that Ms. Knighting's Fifth Amendment right was violated by this question. This is more along the lines of a policy consideration that has been considered by other state jurisdictions, that when you put that choice to someone, you're basically, and without offering them immunity, you're basically asking them to convict themselves, to confess to having contraband on them. And that's not really a choice at all. And that shouldn't be something that is called a choice and makes their presence there voluntary or their intent to bring the item in voluntary. So in this case, we have a female officer who arrested Ms. Knighting. She had ample opportunity, as Mr. McKinney said, she saw it, she felt it, she questioned it. Why didn't she grab it? Then we wouldn't have to be here. And we know that it was, you know, in between her buttocks, but it was plainly visible. She was moving around a lot. It was a fairly bulky package. And we know from recent decisions, such as, I think, Keenan, where it was appropriate for the officer to simply pull back the arrestee's pants and grab the item out from the area there.
Even law enforcement safety concerns about accidentally poking themselves on a hypodermic needle or on a knife or something, why would you suggest that the officer take that risk?
The officers are trained. They performed the pat down and felt a bulky object. They did not feel a syringe, and I think the officers can, from their experience, know that people hide bulky objects such as narcotics in that area, not things that will poke the arrestee, such as needles. I think the officers are experienced enough to know that typically it's a package of drugs that's down someone's pants, as we saw in the Jones case. Her ongoing possession was not a new offense, even when she's picked up and carried to a different location. And here, as Justice Bevin pointed out, we do have an inconsistency in the charging language. She was charged by information with possession. However, the jury convicted her of introduction. An introduction requires...
Right, but hold on a minute. I just looked at the special verdict form and they convicted her of possession. The special verdict question is is couched specifically in terms of possession of certain articles within a correctional facility.
And that is the title of the chapter. And I can't explain the inconsistency, and no one pointed it out below. I noticed this, but it was in favor of our defendant because of the language. Introduce is more than possess. Introduce is stricter than possession. It's to bring in, especially for the first time. So that makes the actus reus here even greater than just simply possessing. It's bringing it, and so you must be bringing it to a location. And in this part, it was the jail, and she did not bring it. The officer brought her with it in her pocket. And so, and also I think that Justice Mueller had a safety question regarding her bringing, it was for safety of the officers and safety of the inmates. They asked this question about contraband and if they have any contraband on their person. But if they really were concerned about safety, they could give her immunity. That was never discussed in this case. No one ever offered to say, if you tell us what you have, we won't charge you with bringing any contraband in, and we won't charge you with whatever contraband you have on you. So if that is a legitimate concern, that could easily be remedied by a promise of immunity, and most defendants would probably jump at that chance. Now, Ms. Knighting possessed the methamphetamine while she was at her car. Her transport to the jail was unanticipated, and she was simply still holding it in her pants. She didn't commit a new offense. There was no act. There was no actus reus, and we know from a case like Martin that there needs to be a specific act. There needs to be not only the possession, but also the act of introducing. Otherwise, you have a situation where they forcibly carried an intoxicated man into a public area and charged him with a totally different crime. And that just doesn't make sense here. So we would ask that this court find that the jury could not have reasonably found that she had introduced methamphetamine or possessed methamphetamine in the jail. We'd ask that the evidence be determined to be insufficient and that she be acquitted on that charge.
Well, thank you. This matter is now under advisement. We'll render a decision. We'll see you back here at 10 o'clock.
Thank you, Your Honor.